This isn't your typical podcast. This is Selling Isn't Everything. And selling's not everything, but in this episode, we did have the opportunity to hear from the great April Dunford, who is the premier positioning expert on how to do your sales pitch and your demo in a time of AI. And she is fabulous. But the best part is towards the end, where we talk to her about how these principles apply as being a human in her personal life. And when is she going to take a little time off? And how is it being the it girl and balancing her life and her work? You're going to love this one. We sure did.
We're doing this again. It'll be fun.
Yeah, to take two. We decided, as you know, as Brent and I have been doing these, April, that we're going to make them a little less performative. Like, now we're starting the podcast. You know, and like, go. So you're not going to hear us like talking about all your accolades right away. That's going to happen afterwards, where we're going to do that. But
that's fine.
But the conversation we had last time, and from the heart, seriously, ever since I started reading your book, I have been majorly fangirling you. I have it right here. I made my whole team read it. It just shifted everything for me, from what I knew to what has to happen today. And, you know, I was thinking about it, and, you know, both Brent and I have had plenty of experience, you know, training and doing keynotes for Fortune 500 companies. But you have something very different. You have actually been in them doing product positioning, right? And creating the perfect demo. And so that's why we're really excited to have you here, because you have that real world experience. And now you're writing a new book. What's your new book about?
Well, it's not a new book. It's the second edition of an older book. So this first book on positioning, called Obviously Awesome, that book I put out in 2019, and continues to sell a lot of copies. And so most people, if they know me at all, they know me for that book. And I've worked with a lot of companies since then on positioning, and my thinking has shifted in some aspects. And there were things that, you know, when you write a book, it gets out in the world and then you get all kinds of feedback on it. And there's a couple of things in there that I really wanted to do over on that, you know, I explained it a certain way, but people didn't understand what I was talking about because I wasn't doing a very good job of explaining it. And, you know, so there was that. And then there were some things that I just didn't get into in the book because I didn't want to make the book too long or too complicated. But, you know, having worked with 300 or 400 companies since the book came out, there were some things that I thought, okay, you know, it would have been good to add these extra things in. So I, you know, went back to my book people and I was like, I think I want to do a second edition. And nice. So that's coming in February.
Congrats.
Yeah.
So you open in sales pitch, and of course you've got your famous toilet story, and we might even make you tell it. I don't know yet. You've probably told the toilet story like 1,000 times.
Yeah. So many times that I started to worry about being branded as the toilet lady for a while. You know, people would literally come up to me and be like, oh, the toilet.
It's the toilet lady.
And that might be good. I mean, it's very memorable and very visceral, right?
I mean, that was the idea.
That's not the positioning you were going for. Is that what you're saying, April?
No, but I did put it in there on purpose. Particularly, the example I'm trying to illustrate with that story is that in tech companies in particular, I don't think we think enough as vendors about how difficult it is to buy the things that we are selling. And so, you know, there's this assumption that customers know a lot more than they do. Customers are, you know, there's this assumption that they've really studied the alternatives and they really know what they want and whatever. And my experience has been the opposite of that. You know, customers are experts in pain. We're experts in solutions. And so, but when I was having conversations with founders and CEOs about that. I mean, they'd be like, no, our stuff is easy. Our stuff is really easy. Like, it's, you know, that might be true for other things, but not us. And so I wanted an example of something that you would think would be really easy to buy. But then when you actually embark on a journey to go buy it, it turns out there's too many things to think about. So I started that book with this example of me trying to buy a toilet.
I don't know, Brent, do we make her tell the story? I don't know. It's such a good one.
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, there's toilets and then there's toilets. You know, it's like there's a Japanese toilet, good luck, right? And then there's an American toilet, which is pretty standard. But even there, you get like oval.
Even an American toilet, though.
You get the higher height and the lower height, right? Do you go with the almond or do you go with the white?
It's not even that. Like there's a lot of different flushing technology, which I did not think about until. Yeah. So here's the story. I'm doing this renovation on this bathroom, you know, and I got this guy and he's doing the reno and he says, look, you got to pick out a toilet. And I'm like, okay, never bought a toilet before, but how hard could that be? It's just a freaking toilet. So anyways, I go to the toilet store and I walk in and the sales rep comes over and says, can I help you? And I'm like, yeah, I'm here to buy a toilet. And he says, what kind of toilet do you want? And I'm like, the flushy
internal
one.
Internal plumbing, like, not the outhouse.
Like, I just want a regular toilet. And he says, the toilets are all over there. You go over there, you know, have a look. And, you know, the prices are all on them and the features and stuff. And you go figure out which one you want. Then you come tell me, I'll get it for you. Okay. So I go over there and there's like 100 toilets and they all look the same. And they all look the same, but they're not, right? Some of them cost $200 and some of them cost $1,000. And there's all this toilet technology, like there's all this flushing technology, like there's gravity assisted flush, and then there's not gravity assisted. Some of them have flappers and some of them don't have flappers. And I don't know what a flapper is. And I'm like in there going, oh my God, like I don't know enough about toilets to buy a toilet. So I spend like an hour in there and I'm like, I'm educated enough. And I go home and I start, you know, Googling freaking toilets. And I'm like, you know, so I'm learning all this thing and there's like this seat height and the different flushing and there's flappers and there's trapways and there's all this stuff. And it just started to feel really overwhelming to me. And I was kind of like, I just want a toilet that flushes, man. I don't want to be a toilet expert. I don't want to spend hours on that. And so in the end, I made the decision not to buy a toilet at all because I was like, you know what? The toilet that was in there was working all right. Like it wasn't broken. And yeah, maybe it's kind of older, but you know, and so I just decided I was going to avoid the thing altogether, you know? So I was like, you know, I went to the toilet store twice. I spent all this time on the internet trying to research what toilet to buy. And in the end, how many toilets did I buy? I bought zero toilets.
I'm just so glad that story ends with the fact that you already had a toilet as opposed to deciding to live without one altogether.
Right. I was like, there's a backyard.
I just decided not to buy one at all. It's like, oh my God, what did she do?
So I'm comparing this to people who sell products, right? Where they're like, but it seems so easy. And I think a lot of buyers start the buyer journey with that idea. Like, okay, we're going to go buy accounting software, right? How hard could it be? But then you're out there and there's 1,000 different packages and they all look the same. And they all say, we're the number one accounting software. And, you know, and then there's all these features and everyone's pitching all their features. And it's like me looking at flappers. I don't know what a flapper is. Like, do I need one? Do I not need one? And it's the same way that people are talking about, you know, we have the next generation AI, something or other. And the customer don't know what that is.
You know, it's interesting, April, in the book, The Framing Sale, that's the one I just did. We tell a version of the story with about shopping on Amazon. You might have bumped
into
it, right? And it's the same sort of thing. Like even easy stuff like a dongle is this usually the way I tell that story. It's like, I just need a USB-C dongle. And it ends in a true story, but it's kind of tongue in cheek, but again, true, which is, you know, after 3 hours of shopping for a dongle and just getting overwhelmed because they all kind of look the same, you don't know what to do. And everything's got a one star saying you're a schmuck if you buy this because it's going to break. It's like, well, I don't want to do that one. And so finally, you just kind of get exhausted. And, you know, and Amazon has this button that makes all the pain stop. And the button says save for later. And I always joke, it's like you don't get a dongle, but you do get your life back, right? And whenever I tell that story, it ends with the true story of my wife has 582 items saved for later in her Amazon account. And it just kind of makes me wonder, just how does commerce even happen?
Right.
Sometimes, you know, it's like to your point, it's like if you already have it now, if you didn't have a toilet at all, you were going to buy a toilet. You were going to have to make a decision. But the fact you already had one led you to a place where, like, you know, actually this is a little bit of commerce. It doesn't need to happen. And it strikes me that the thing that we're really either competing against or with, or the opportunity that is in front of us, is not out positioning the competition, although that's important. It is getting positioning right in order to make more decisions happen, right? To just get more, to help customers make more decisions. Is that
right?
Kind of see like that or not?
Well, yeah. Like, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. Like one is customers, if we're talking, like most of the stuff that I do is enterprise B2B software. Yeah. And so in enterprise B2B software, the stakes are high, you know, like, and so often there's the pull, like, you know, we failed the audit or something terrible happened, and that's why we're looking for new accounting software. But then somebody sort of gets assigned to be the champion of that deal, right? And they're like, okay, you figure it out, buddy. And then you convince IT and convince everybody else that this is the right thing. And then come back to me. I'm the economic buyer. I'll sign the check and then you'll go do it. But I think we underestimate how fraught that decision is, right? So even when the person has to make decision, like, you know, their boss has told them, go figure this out. Like, this is kind of a high stakes thing. Like, if I buy the wrong dongle, you know, I feel stupid and I'm mad and maybe I wasted $10 or something, but it ain't the end of the world. But man, if I picked the wrong accounting software, it is kind of the end of the world. Professionally,
probably the end of your job. That's right.
It could be the end of my job. Yeah. It could be I don't get the promotion I thought I was going to get. It could be I look stupid in front of my boss. It could be my peers are like, that's the idiot that picked that thing that we now have to use every day and we hate it. Like, there's stakes in these decisions. So great positioning, I think, does a couple of things. Like, one, it makes it really clear what the value is you're going to get if you pick me. But it's not me in isolation. It's me versus everything else you could do. And one of those things is do nothing. Right. One of those things is just keep using the spreadsheet or just keep using the crappy accounting thing that got you into trouble in the first place. And I think part of our responsibility as marketers and salespeople in these situations is to give the buyer this sense of confidence that they've looked at their options and this isn't going to go sideways for them if they pick us.
Well, and you talk about helping them. What I think you both do, and I was saying this to Brent before, I got to sit on Brent's, on the Gartner Thought Leader panel. That's where Brent and I met. And when they came out with sense making, that just changed my world too. It was like,
my stuff derives from that too, right? Like, I think anybody in enterprise software that has spent any time trying to sell stuff talks like this.
Correct. And founders are the worst because a founder is so excited about all their features and benefits that they just want to show you all 56 of them now.
Right.
Right. Before you even know that you have a need for the thing, which is also a big default. I guess what I wanted to ask you, April, and this is so fun for me, knowing your work now and obviously having worked alongside Brent for over 5 years. And that is, you know, in Gartner's work, they talk about sense making, right? And it seems like the enemy, if you will, is status quo. And it feels like in your work, one of the enemies is status quo, but it's also differentiated value. That all makes sense to me. Once you get on a sales call, we want to frame it. We want to differentiate the value. Yeah. And looking for a product like this, you know, here's three things you want to consider whether you go with us or not. You know, and I'm going to help you. I'm going to be the trusted advisor. Love that. Makes all the sense in the world to me.
Yeah.
What I'm asking is, when it comes to marketing, since you have the marketing background that you do, the product marketing background, let's say I'm asking for a friend. You get a lot of inbound leads because it's sales kickoff season. Okay. Get them on the phone, no problem. We can differentiate, do a great discovery, show the value. But let's say they've probably got a RFP out to 5-7 speakers, right? Like, because they had somebody, you know, go find us a SKO speaker for this event. So they've got somebody doing it. When you haven't gotten on the phone yet, when you haven't gotten the call yet, from a marketing perspective, do you start differentiating your value, knowing that they're that far along in their buyer's journey? What does that look like from a marketing perspective?
Well, there's a whole bunch of things. One of the key parts of positioning is, you know, yes, you have to understand what your differentiated value is, which is why pick me over the other guys, really. Like, you know, why pick me over keeping with the status quo? Why pick me over anybody else that might end up on the short list against me? And so I really need to understand what's the value I could deliver that nobody else can. So that's kind of critical in your positioning. However, because I come from B2B, like, not everybody cares about that value the same, right? So, you know, so I got this value I can deliver that no one else can, but, you know, the universe of people that really, really care a lot about that value is smaller than the universe of people that, you know, I could meet their needs. It would be fine. But what does an actual best fit customer look like? So on the marketing side, we need to really understand what our differentiated value is. Yes. But we also need to understand, well, who's a really good fit for that value? And then I have to understand, how do I intercept those people when they are early in a purchase journey? So before they get to sales, and that's my job at marketing is, you know, I want you to know I exist and what I do and why you should pick me so that I get on the short list in the first place so that my sales team even gets to talk to anybody. And most of the stuff that I see, like if I, you know, when I look at marketing and B2B, like the biggest mistake everyone's making is they're just trying to sell to everybody. I'm trying to sell to everybody. But you aren't the best fit for everybody. You're the best fit for some of the people. And if I can really understand what that, like what those companies are like, then I can go and target them where they live and where they hang out. So I'll give you an example. I worked as this was a really long time ago. I was working for this company as a consultant. This is before this iteration of this consulting business, but I was actually in between, you know, I had a vice president of marketing job and I came out of that one. We got acquired. I came out and I was looking for a new one. But in the meantime, I knew these guys and they said, could you just come in temporarily and help fix this thing? I'm like, yeah, okay. And so they had this solution for business analysts. And it was like a project management solution for business analysts. And so I didn't even know what they meant when they said business analyst, but that's like a person inside a company that's managing an internal software project. Like we're going to build some software for the company to use, but we're not a software company. We're not selling that. It's an internal project. Okay, fine. That's a terrible market for starters. There's lots of big companies in that market. Like you could pick Jira or Asana or, you know, pick your favorite billion-dollar company that does that exact same thing. And so anyways, I came in and it was clear that no one really had their arms around, well, you know, why would you pick us versus Jira? Or why would you pick us versus Asana? And then nobody really had their arms around, like, who's a really good fit for us? You know, we were just trying to market to everybody and trying to market all the features to everybody. So we did this and they had a sales team that, you know, was all brand new. So everybody, like, I guess they'd had a lot of turnover in sales. So when you went over and talked to sales, normally you could say, like, what's a good fit prospect look like? A good salesperson could kind of give you some info on that. These people have got nothing. Right. That's where they're like, it's good. And they're like, well, I don't know. Take our victim where we find them, basically. So we decided, well, we're going to go dig into this. So we did this little win analysis. So we took the last like 30 deals that had happened in this company. We got the champion on the phone and we were like, okay, take me back. What were you doing before? And in the first one I did, the guy says, we were using Jira. And I was like, well, that's good software, man. Like, what made you decide you weren't going to use Jira? And the guy says, well, what actually happened was we acquired another software company. So all of a sudden we had remote teams and we had to do things across teams. And that turned out that was a real pain in the neck to do with Jira. And you guys had this feature and this feature and this feature, made that really easy to manage. So we switched to you. And I was like, that's funny because we don't even talk about that stuff. We weren't messaging around that. We were like, they had to be real sleuths to figure this out. But we're like, okay. So we write that down. And then I get on the phone with the next guy and I'm like, take me back. What were you doing before? And they're like, oh, we were using Asana. I'm like, great software. Why on earth would you stop using them? And they said, well, we actually decided we were going to outsource some development. And then we had distributed teams. And so that it turned out that was a pain. And so, we switched to you and I'm like, well. So we did like 30 of these calls. Every single one, it was kind of the same thing. It was all about distributed teams. So you're like, okay, first of all, we got this value prop around being able to manage manage these projects when the teams aren't all together. So we could message around that. But here's the second thing. If you didn't have distributed teams, we were not a good choice. We were a terrible choice. So from the marketing perspective, first we got our value really tight. But then we started thinking about, well, who has distributed teams? There's two situations. You either did acquisition or you're outsourcing. Like, these are the two big things. So then it's like, well, how do I get in front of companies like this that are doing acquisitions or doing outsourcing? And it turned out, this was a long time ago, but it turned out there was a magazine. It was called Outsourcers Weekly. And I bought a full page ad in Outsourcers Weekly, which was like this dumb thing, but it was basically just advertising our thing and saying, when you're outsourcing, you're going to need a tool that can handle this outsourcing thing. And we're the tool for that for outsourcers. And we did tons of pipeline with that janky little ad. But the point here is that on the marketing side of things, if we get really tight on our positioning, it's not just enough to know what the value is. It's who cares a lot about that value. And that's going to inform the message that I take and then where that message lives. Because especially if I'm a startup, I can't just blast the world with my message. And I'm not trying to sell to everybody. I'm trying to sell to somebody who's a really good fit for my stuff.
See, that is so gold, April. We actually used we had a company summit, our company last week in California, and we used one of your formats. And we had the same startling realization that where are we really moving the needle? Where are we really increasing win rate, increasing deal velocity, decreasing ramp time? And we found out we cannot work in a company unless the enablement leader, they have a really strong enablement leader that's involved. And if they don't, no deal. Yeah. And that was like a big aha for us that, we need to be able to train the trainers and the managers within the company, or our methodology is not going to work. And that was like a big aha after doing this for 28 years.
Right.
We hadn't even thought of that. So,
right. Like this should happen naturally, right? A lot of the times when people are just marketing to everybody, like part of it is they're not really clear on the value. If we can get really tight on the value, then we can lean back and say, okay, if the value is that, who really cares? And it, in the work that I do with clients, like we'll start with this idea, like if you didn't exist, what would the customer do? So we figure out what the alternatives are, which includes status quo. And then we look at what have we got that they don't have? And then how does that translate to value? And if we can get really tight on that, then we can say, okay, well, who cares a lot about that value? Because like, let's be honest, it ain't everybody. And so if you can get tight on value plus who you're trying to go after, then that gives marketing a lot of play to design campaigns that have this very strong message going at this very narrow set of people that are most likely to buy and most likely to care about being on the receiving end of that message.
April, something I want to explore with you, which is one is on the business level, and then there's kind of another level if we get there. It would be really interesting to get your take on it. But it's something that you say relatively easily, which I know from, I'm guessing, from experience, is actually really, really hard. And as you need to start with your unique strengths, because this is, of course, heart and soul of the challenger sale as well, right? Which is when people say, if I'm going to go challenge customers' thinking, and then they take that insight and put it out to RFP, you're just a free consultant. So how do you avoid that? And it's like, well, whatever you teach your customers about their business has to lead back to your unique strengths. And so
that's right.
There's this moment, and it was back in 2000. 2008, when we were first building the Challenger work, and we were in a conference room, and we were talking about this idea of insight, and we were saying, well, what would have to be true about this insight such that you ensure that when you challenge customers with it, you actually get paid for it? And someone in the room, one of our consultants said, well, clearly it's going to have to lead back to your unique strengths. So we said, so we all said, ooh, that makes sense, right? And so we put on I literally remember we wrote on the whiteboard and eventually it became in a page and it became part of our presentation, became part of the book. And then I started traveling all over the world saying those words to rooms of heads of sales and heads of marketing. It's like, whatever you teach your customer about their business needs to lead back to your unique strengths, which means, of course, that you need to know what your unique strengths are. And it was at that moment, April, that I realized that everyone in the room was kind of awkwardly shuffling their feet and staring at their shoes. Do you know what I'm talking about? Because it's like, oh dear. You know, it's like, well, we don't actually know that. But what I really learned, with huge respect to all those individuals with good intentions, trying their best to do a good job, what I learned is it's actually freaking hard. I mean, it's like really, really hard. And I've been in workshops where we've tried to do that with companies I've been at. So it's, and as I always say, it's one thing to know what your strengths are. That to make an inventory of your strengths is not easy, but it's doable. But to come up with a list of unique strengths that truly set you apart.
Right.
And the story you just told, I think, is super interesting, because one tactic to do that I never really fully appreciate is, like, ask your customers, which is not exactly what you said, but you kind of did, which I thought. Has this been your experience? And what have you learned about, like, I just find this really actually hard to do what is at the heart of what you say.
So much stuff. So I have so many opinions about this. Okay, here's the first one that I think gets tech companies really messed up. So with my stuff, we start with, like, if we're trying to figure out differentiated value, I need to know differentiated from what, right? So I need to understand what the customer is comparing me to. So we start there with this stake in the ground. Like, and the question is this: if you didn't exist, what would a customer do? You would think that's an easy question, but it ain't.
Yeah.
And most of the time, when these companies come, like, and I've had lots of companies come to me and say, look, this is a mature market. We don't have anything that's different. And I'm like, how much revenue do you do right now? And they'll say 100 million. And I'll be like, is it growing? Yeah, 20%. Okay, so dude, every day people make that comparison and pick you. They're picking you for a reason. You might not know what that reason is. You might not like that reason, but they are picking you for a reason. So, but when you get at the root cause of this, like why they think there's no differentiation, even though a customer does, because the customer picks them, it's because they don't really understand the comparisons the customer is making. And so if I ask product management, if you didn't exist, what would a customer do? They give me a giant laundry list of companies. It is so big. Like, it's huge. And there's a whole bunch of companies there that you have never heard of. Nobody's ever heard of. Your customer has never heard of. Because there's three guys in a basement in Silicon Valley. And they've literally never sold anything. They're not a threat to anyone now. And now, product management lives in the future, right? They're thinking about roadmap. They're thinking about where we're going. And they're like, yeah, but they're gonna, man. Like, we're gonna, like, 3 years from now, they're gonna start causing us pain. And I'm like, yeah, but from a positioning perspective, I don't have to position against the ghost. Like, you know, if a customer doesn't hear about them, they don't end up on a short list. I don't have to position against them. So we take them off the list. Like, if at some point they start causing us pain, we'll adjust the positioning to account for it. But right now they're not showing up, so take them off the list. And then marketing, if you ask marketing, like, who's our big competitor, they'll tell you whoever's spending the most money on marketing. But we know, same thing. Lots of times that those companies don't show up on the short list. They're going after somebody else. Who knows what? Or they flame out and they're dead in a year because they blew their brains out on marketing that didn't work. But but we don't know that. And then sales, if I go ask sales, if we didn't exist, what would they do? They can always tell me who the shortlist competitors are, but they don't count status quo, right? Because they don't see that as a competitor. If we lose the status quo, we didn't lose. It just means not today, but next year we're going to get those guys or whatever. So in my work, we start there. And so if we can actually narrow it down to what is the status quo that we're generally replacing and who actually ends up on a short list, that is generally a pretty short list. Like, you know, in some companies, it's longer. But, you know, first we got to get that. Then once we get that, then we can say, okay, now, what have you got that the other guys don't have? It's not always unique, because sometimes what you have is, I got a thing that differentiates against this category of competitors. Mm-hmm. And I got a different thing that differentiates against this category of competitors. And my unique thing is I'm the only one that has both. Mm. So often we get that. Mm-hmm. But often we've got a thing that's really, like, once you take out three guys in a basement that don't sell anything, we have lots of differentiating stuff. But we, you know, the company feels like, well, it's not totally unique, you know, because three guys in a basement have it. It's like, dude, it's unique in terms of what your customer sees as actual companies they might actually buy from. So we get to that. And it's sometimes it's stuff that we don't actually think is such a big deal. But it's a big deal for customers. So let me give you an example. So when I worked at IBM, this was a long, long time ago. So this is different at IBM now. But back when I worked at IBM, we were selling this database. And we were up against Oracle. And this is a mature market even back then. And so if you did a feature function checklist, us versus Oracle, we're all the same. Like, we all have the same stuff. We all have the same features. We all just, we're exactly the same. The only real differentiator between us and Oracle was Oracle wasn't just trying to sell you a database. They were trying to sell you the whole stack, database, middleware, application, all bundled nice together. And we were trying to sell you the whole thing. Whereas at IBM, we didn't have applications. So you know, we looked at databases like middleware. And so we were trying to sell you a database that played nice with everything else. And so we were much more open. So the only real feature function stuff we had different, we had better APIs, we adhered to open standards better, we sat on all the open standards bodies, we cared a lot about that, we played really nice with all kinds of commercial software plus open source software and all that stuff. So that was the differentiated capability, just that. And, you know, at the bottom of the list of 9,000 features, there was this, you know, a little bit better API, blah, blah, blah. So then you say, well, what's the value of that? Well, the value of that is that, you know, you've got all this data sitting in this database and you can use it for all kinds of things without necessarily having to put it into some other different data thing, you know? So the fact that it's open is that you can do all kinds of stuff with it. So then when we're building the sales pitch around this thing, the insight on that, like what you were talking about, is this insight has to advantage you right from the beginning. Like, we'd come out and we'd say, yes, there's lots of data, you know, there's data all over the place. Why are we saving all this data in the first place? Because you're going to do stuff with it, right? Like, you're going to do machine learning on it. You're going to do AI on it. You're saving it because the assumption on the tech side of things is this data is eventually going to become a strategic business asset. So, if I'm buying a database because I think that data is going to be a strategic business asset, I don't want it locked in over in this closed thing over here. Like, shouldn't that be the main requirement that the thing be open? And so we would start there.
You know, one of the things that I have found, and it's actually something I want to focus on more, at least in the stuff I'm doing going forward, but it's been a really powerful tool in our research and actually in the heart and soul of a lot of the models and the work we did with at CEB, is the difference between difference in degree and difference in kind. And I'm wondering if this is something you think about either consciously or just subconsciously in your work and positioning. So there's, you know, a difference in degree is like, we do the same thing. We do it better, or we do it faster. Like, it's the old Spinal Tap. Ours goes to 11, right? So it's the same thing. It's just more of it, or maybe less of it, right? There's a difference in degree versus difference in kind, which maybe is self-explanatory. It does something different altogether. Right. And maybe something you've never thought of being valuable, but turns out is more valuable than you realize. And what I find is that positioning that's based on difference in degree is often more susceptible to commoditization than difference in kind. Is that something you've seen in your work as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, most of the companies that I work with now, if you look at what's going on, we're not actually having a feature function comparison. It's an approach to the problem comparison. And usually what we're trying to do in the sales pitch that leads to our value is, look, like there's different, there's fundamentally different ways of solving this problem. You could solve it this way and it's good for this, bad for this, or you could solve it this way, good for this, bad for this. But we looked at that and decided there's a completely different way to solve this problem. And if we solve it in this way, that unlocks this different value. And so most of the stuff I'm doing, like when we get to the sales pitch, there's a part in the sales pitch where we teach the customer that.
Yeah.
And where we basically say, look, like, we, you know, we've worked with hundreds of companies, thousands of companies sometimes, and here's what we've seen. There's different approaches. And we're not actually even naming the competitors. We're saying, look, like, you could approach it this way, or you could approach it this way, or you could approach it this way. But, it, you know, knowing what we know about the problem, the approach would be this. Like, even that IBM example in some ways is sort of like, it's a difference of philosophy about what databases are all about.
Right, so you're differentiating your approach to solving the problem. So that's the way that you're selling in and of itself is completely differentiated.
Well, yeah, yeah. But usually, and so a lot of the companies that I work with, the struggle they're having in positioning is explaining that. It's in telling a story around, because if they go straight to the value at the end, and if they abstract it out all the way to like pure, pure, pure value, you're like, we're going to help you save money. Yeah, they're going to help you save money too, right? Like, what's, so what? Aren't we all the same? And often the devil is in the details of this stuff. It's like, no, we're going to save you a lot more money. Well, how are you going to do that? Well, because we're doing this in a completely different way. And when we do it in this completely different way, instead of doing 20 documents a day, you can do 1,000 documents a day. Oh, that's how we're going to save money. But it's not enough to just make the claim. Like, we actually have to kind of get into a little bit, like in enterprise software, we kind of got to get into the guts of it a little bit. Like, why is it so different? If I were IBM and I just went and said, oh, I've got APIs, Oracle's would say, yeah, I got APIs too, right?
It all makes perfect sense. At an intellectual level, we get that. And yet, we're dealing with probably very few enterprise salespeople that can actually do it, right?
Well, that is the big problem that I'm trying to solve right now. Like, in all my companies, the goal of the workshop is we want to get really tight positioning. And then we want to get a sales pitch that a brand new sales rep that doesn't know anything about this stuff could have a high level conversation about exactly that.
So then let me ask you this. And then, Brent, I know you've got a couple of personal questions for sure. Because selling isn't everything. Although today, selling is the whole podcast is called Selling Isn't Everything. And I think, you know,
it's all about selling today.
Today is all about selling because it's like, it's so fascinating because really you're coming at this from a little bit of a different plane than a lot of people, right? You're taking what's very complex and you're, you know, distilling it down so it can be very simple, as you said, for onboarding for a brand new rep. I guess the big question that I have in all of this is, in a time of AI, right, where all of the messaging, all of the content does sound the same. Now we're going to give enterprise sellers a pitch that is fairly unified. And I believe we need to have freedom and structure in anything that we train our reps on. I mean, you've got to have a structure and then give them a certain amount of freedom within that structure. I guess my question is in this time of AI, what's more important, or how do you see the relationship between the message and the messenger?
AI is funny, right? Because we have things that are making companies very confused. So for example, if you're a venture-backed startup right now and you're trying to raise money, there's no way anybody is writing you a check unless you're positioning your company as an AI thing, because that's the only thing that's getting checks right now. And so your investor pitch needs to be very, this is an AI thing and we're disrupting the market and blah, 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 blah. But on the customer side, that's not necessarily the way you want to position it, because everybody's got an AI thing. And, you know, in that, And again, the customer cares more about, like, so what? So you got the AI thing, but so what for my business? Like, why, you know, there's lots of AI things. Why your AI thing versus everybody else's AI thing? And it, you know, and AI, and for most of these companies, is the how we get the value done. It's not the value. Now, unfortunately, and we've seen this movie before, you know, when everybody was first going to the cloud, for example. Unfortunately, when we have this kind of big new technological advancement that comes out, you will have some customers, some buyers will react to that by saying, oh man, we need to get the AI. And to the extent where they say we have an AI initiative and there's budget attached to that initiative, and I can't buy anything if it doesn't come out of the AI budget, so you better come in here and tell me about how this has the AI. We're going to do this thing. In the same way this happened, like whenever it was 5-10 years ago, when everything was going to the cloud, some companies were like, oh my gosh, we really got to get on this cloud thing. And they had a budget for cloud stuff. And then people were coming in and they'd be like, you better tell me how this is going to all happen in the cloud. But my experience in that is it's kind of a temporary thing. You know, like nobody's doing that now for cloud stuff, right? It's just assumed that the stuff is in the cloud. It's just assumed that, yeah, of course it's in the cloud, of course. And I think we're going to have the same thing with a lot of this AI stuff. Like, of course your product has AI. Of course your product's taking advantage of AI. That's not what's special about it. What's special about it is the way you do that and what that enables. And again, what's the value I'm going to get? Like, what are you going to do for my business? The fact that there's AI in the plumbing, who cares?
Back to toilets.
Yeah. Right. So, I think it'll end up, you know, in 5 years, we'll laugh that we all said, oh, you know, we were AI and changed the company name to .AI and all that stuff. But it's not funny now because, you know, again, if you're trying to raise money, you got to play the game. And if you happen to be selling to customers that are like, we have this bucket of money and we can't buy it unless you say it's an AI thing. Well, we're going to say it's an AI thing, man. We want that budget. So we're at this kind of awkward teenage phase with the AI stuff that in some cases we're trying to lean into AI where, you know, if everything was a bit more mature, we wouldn't on the messaging side. So what really matters is understanding your customer and where they're at, right? So if the customer is like, yeah, AI, whatever, then we might have to spin it that way. But if the customer is just like, you know, tell me what the value is, and then we can explain how we do it if they're interested in that. But if they're not, we don't even have to go there. So I don't know. We're at a weird little juncture right now with this AI stuff.
April, I've been wondering about this for a while, and I really want to get your reaction. And I'm going to ask you something that's either going to completely engage you or completely lose you. And I'm not sure which, but here's,
oh no,
but I quite mean this sincerely. And I'm just wondering, because this is kind of where my mind goes oftentimes, is how much of what you talk about is just really not about B2B business, but really about human relationships, just dressed up in business casual clothing. Do you know what I mean? It's in other words, the fact that companies struggle to define their unique strengths may in fact just be a byproduct that we all as individuals struggle to find our own unique value. The fact
it is deep, but I
do wonder about these things, right? So, and I don't know, do you ever think about this kind of stuff or am I on an island on this one? Because so much of what you talk about is really could be transposed to human relationships and friendships and dating and just, you know, attracting, you know, people who are interested in being around you. And I wonder to what degree we could take all these lessons that you talk about, which are so valuable, take them out of AI and data clouds and all that and make it about going on a date and finding a mate. I don't know.
Well, you know, when I was first writing my first book about positioning, this is obviously awesome, I was shopping it around to publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And the publishers didn't like it because they thought it was too narrow and, you know, because it was focused on tech companies.
I had this conversation before. I know exactly what you're talking
about. Yeah. So what they wanted to do was kind of like positioning your life, like, you know, and so they wanted it to be that. They wanted it to be kind of a self-help book, like,
yeah,
how to position anything, basically. And, you know, and like you're saying, getting a date or doing whatever. And I was like, but man, I'm running a consulting business. I don't want to be a therapist.
Yeah.
So I didn't write that book. But I do think that some of this stuff kind of does apply. Like, you know, it's certain, like, I don't know how much of it applies to, like, going on dates and stuff. Like, but I certainly applied a lot of it to myself, like, in my career. Like, you know, you're going on interviews, and that's exactly what the interview is. Like, why hire you and not the other guys? Like, why pick you over everybody else? And at the beginning, you know, when you're junior and you're in marketing, like, there's 1,000,000,000 junior marketers they could hire. Like, why you and not the other guys? And then even when I made the switch to doing consulting, you know, it took me a while to get my positioning kind of solid on that, because, like, there's lots of great marketers around that you can hire as a consultant that have done cooler things than me, man. Like, you know, they went and worked at wherever, Facebook or Google or something. And I never worked at any big famous companies before I switched into consulting. So I was like, why would you hire me and not the gal that worked at Google or the gal that spent 10 years at Facebook? And so I do think this stuff kind of applies in a general sense in a lot of ways that people don't think about it enough, like, particularly, like, people that are brand new to consulting, like, and they're like, hi, I'm a fractional CMO. And I'm like, that's terrible positioning. Like, oh my God, there's so many of those. Like, there are so many of those.
But real quick, just check this out. Cause, like, the one you just mentioned, like, I'm a new hire, or at least I'm an aspiring new hire.
Yeah.
And so this goes back to our difference in degree versus different in kind. Oh, your GPA is a 4.97. I thought it was a 4.95. You think, well, now I'll hire you. It's like, is it competing on difference in degree? Or like you're in a dating scenario. It's like, oh, you can bench press 500 pounds and not 480 pounds. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm wondering, just in life, there seems to be at the heart and soul of what you do is a series of really powerful life lessons that I'm wondering if maybe... it's because you weren't really, it's not your point to go after them, but they're still there nonetheless. And I think it's really interesting to me, at least, to say, how do you port this work into how do I show up in such a way where I not only know my unique strengths, but I'm confident in them. I understand that they're unique. They're different in kind, not just different in degree. Yeah. And they're, to your point, tied into what my customer, that is the person I'm trying to build a relationship with, cares about in the first place. This is what you're writing about, is about life. It isn't just about business.
I do think there's this big component of empathy in it, right? Mm-hmm. Which is being able to put yourself in the customer's shoes and think like a customer. You know, like, if you think about, where does bad positioning come from? It comes from you not understanding how a customer sees your stuff. So you could say the same thing if we were talking about life, right? Like, you're trying to get a date or whatever, whatever it is you're trying to do. You got to kind of put yourself in the shoes of the person that you're trying to impress or whatever and think, well, how does this look to them? Right. Like, and so, you know, how would I convince them that I'm an interesting person? I'm a good person to hang out. I'm a whatever. But kind of the first step is to sort of get out of your own head and get into the other person's head and be like, well, how do I look at myself like that? Like, again, if I take the example of I'm a fractional CMO, like, that is very internal. Like, I've been a CMO and now I'm coming out and now I'm thing. So I'm a fractional CMO. But if you actually sat back and looked at what does a customer want, like, if they want a fractional CMO, what they want is a full-time CMO. They just don't want to pay for it. So you're basically saying, I'm kind of the crappy version of that you're only going to get for 3 days. I'm never going to meet your expectations and I'm going to charge you less. Like, all of that is bad. They're not getting what they want. You're not getting what you want. It's terrible positioning. So I do think kind of at the root of all this is, you know, getting out of you and your product and saying, this is what's so great about us, blah, blah, blah. But getting in the head of the person on the other side of that, and being like, what are they looking for? What do they want? So, and how does that stack up with what I've got, right? And if I got something that's special, and if I got something that's special, like, who cares about that? Not everybody does.
Yep.
So I have a question for both of you in all of this, because I'm listening to all this, and April, I absolutely agree with you, Brent, that you know, these are universal truths. We talk about that quite a bit, that these are life lessons. They're not just, you know, how we go to market lessons. And April, what you're saying about, you know, you've got to put yourself in the customer's shoes, but where does cognitive bias come into all of this? Where does, I mean, when you're dating, like, there's pheromones, right? Like, oh God, I don't know why I'm in love with you, but you just smell so good. Like, you know, like, that's real. Pheromones are real, right? Or, wow, you're standing next to another really attractive guy, so you look even more attractive and you're available. Or, you know, or the cognitive bias of influencer.
Sure, you've given this a lot of thought.
No, I mean, I think, I don't know how rational we all are in our decision making. I wish we were, but I don't know that we are.
Yeah, but even if we aren't, again, if I take this back to B2B software, right? I don't think B2B software gets bought in a rational way at all. I think a lot of B2B software is purchased out of fear, right? It's the fear of making the wrong choice. It's really irrational. I don't think a lot of rational people would choose Salesforce as a CRM. I'm just going to say that. Like, you know, it is...
There goes our sponsor, Brent. God darn it.
Sorry. But I mean, it's not a super loved product. It's aging. It's well over designed. It's not a beautiful UI. It's not a beautiful experience at this point. But it is a very safe product to choose. It is by far the number one on the market. It works with everything. You're not going to get fired for picking that. And I think that's the same, you know, so I don't think B2B software buyers are super rational people. I think there's a lot of, you really have to put this fear thing to bed if any commerce is going to happen at all, because there's fear. I think when we get into other things, like we're talking about dating and whatever else, and this is why I don't do any consumer marketing, because on the consumer side, it's a lot more complicated, right? Like when I'm selling things to, you know, I'm selling B2B software, I know that fear thing is present, but I also know that my champion has to sell to their boss. And when they're going to sell to the boss, they've got to explain how this thing is going to help them make money or save money. And that's about it. Whereas in consumer stuff, like you buy a lot of consumer stuff for, there's all kinds of definitions of value and all kinds of emotions that can trigger. So, you know, I'm buying a watch because it makes me look like a successful businessman, or, you know, I'm driving this car because, you know, I want people to think I'm cool, or I'm, you know, Kim Kardashian did this thing and I want the same thing, or whatever, right? Because I want to, you know, look cool, look rich, look sexy, get a date. Like there's all kinds of things, right? That, whereas, you know, in B2B, it's a lot simpler. Like a lot of it's just fear. It's fear screwing up. It's fear making a bad decision. It's fear, whatever. And if you can understand where that fear is and try to alleviate it, then, you know, then the opposite side of that is ambition, right? I want to get promoted. I want to look cool in front of my boss. I want this to work out. So we can manage those emotions because they're limited, right? When we get into consumer stuff and outside of this, there's a lot more axes that you could play on.
There's a body of research that's still sitting on the cutting room floor that someday my co-author and I will resurrect, which is gets into this in some really interesting ways. And it turns out it appears that there's actually more there than one might think, particularly when right? So these personal motivations of, so someone might buy from you something because they see the value or they're scared of screwing up. But when it comes to, now I got to go talk to four other people in my company, get them involved, then you the only thing that really is increases the likelihood of that happening are personal motivations, things like it's a longer story for a different time. I should find some time to walk you through that stuff. It's really interesting. But here's what I would suggest to everyone is they go out and buy obviously awesome first edition and second edition, and they also buy Sales Pitch. And if I may, I would suggest, I say this tongue in cheek, but I actually don't, because I think there's a whole dimension, April, to your work that maybe even you haven't fully appreciated. And I say that with huge respect, which is, as you read it, it is what you have there is an instructor's guide to how to position your company and how to stand out in the marketplace. You are literally one of the best in the world at what you do. And it's incredible. And thank you for taking the time with us. As you all go out and buy those books and read them, look at them, consume them through the lens, not just of B2B relations, but people-to-people relations. And I'm guessing you're going to find one or two nuggets in there. They're going to change the way you think, not just about your company, but think about yourself. And I think for that, April, you're amazing.
Great. Thanks. Well, maybe this is my retirement lifestyle. I'll just be a dating coach.
It could happen. I think a lot of people would sign up for that. You'd be surprised.
Oh my God, no.
A lot of people need your help, let me tell you.
Yeah. Oh boy. Yeah. No, I think I'll just play golf instead. I don't know.
You got 2 months a year, you could do that in Toronto. So there.
Yeah, that's right.
I do have a final question for you, sure. April. It almost feels like, I was saying this to Brent earlier, you're kind of the it girl, like you're everywhere, right? And I was listening to your podcast this morning.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
Oh, I mean, you are the it girl right now. You are hot, like you are the
thank
hot
you.
Commodity, right? Good thing you're not on the dating market, right?
I mean, that's good. My marketing's working.
Yeah, your marketing is working. Your podcast is great. How are you balancing all of that at this phase of life that you're in, right? Mm. Where you can kind of choose everything. You sort of tease out that I might retire, but you know, you're here and you're there and you're everywhere. And, you know, we have a lot of different people that watch this podcast, listen to this podcast. And I guess my question is, how are you that it girl at this phase in your life? And how are you balancing all those other elements of what's so important to you personally?
Well, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this lately for a bunch of different reasons. So, I started my consulting business and I was pretty old. Like I was not 50, almost 50, 48, 47. And like old enough that, you know, in tech, people just start looking at you sideways a little bit, being like, you know, maybe you're washed up at this point. And then at the beginning of my consulting business, I worked very hard at it because I didn't know how to do consulting, and I didn't know, so the first few years I was trying to figure out what was this thing all about. And, and I'm a marketer, so, I leaned hard on the marketing stuff. And so, did a lot of writing, a lot of speaking, a lot of stuff on social media, podcasts, and all that stuff. And I'm now at the phase where that stuff is kind of paying off for me. But I'm not one of these people that thinks that they're going to just work like this forever. I do not intend on working like this forever. Like, I think right now I work too much. I think I travel too much. I think there's too much stuff on my plate. And there's a lot of things that I would like to do that have nothing to do with work, like absolutely nothing to do with work. So, and then, last year, I had a bit of a shock last year. My older sister died. And she was 59. And from when she got sick to when she was dead was 6 weeks. And so something like that happens to you, and you start thinking, you know what? Like, how much time have I got left? And I really enjoy the stuff that I do, but there's other things I'd like to do too. And so this thing happened with my sister. And shortly after that, I was like, questioning how much effort I was spending on marketing a business that was doing just fine. And so I ran an experiment where I stopped marketing the business. So I stopped posting on social media, the occasional little post, but I stopped thinking about posting on social media. I stopped doing the podcast. I stopped writing a newsletter. I pop up. I think I did 3 speaking engagements this whole year. So I kind of just stopped marketing as an experiment to see, like, does everything just stop at that point or does it keep going? And the crazy thing is I had my best year ever and I've got my best looking pipeline I've ever had. And so I think as a marketer, I was over-rotating on marketing, to be honest. And I think that sometimes you have the luxury of taking your foot off the gas. And you don't know it unless you take your foot off the gas and then see what happens. And so I'm doing a lot of thinking about how do I dial things down in the business so that it is not this, this all-consuming thing right now. And my plans for next year is to do less of it, like to do fewer clients. I'm pretty picky about who I work with because I'm just me. I don't have some big team. But my plan is to be even pickier next year, work with fewer, better companies, and then have a lot more time to just do other stuff that I want to do that has nothing to do with positioning and tech or any of that.
Take your foot off the gas and see what happens is a
yeah
is a really interesting idea. And yeah. I think, you know, I think if I'm 25 and hard charging up the career ladder, maybe not. But if I'm 45 or 55 or, you know, I'm 57.
Yeah, I'm 58, right? So I'm like, wait a second, right. I started having these internal conversations, like, what do you want this life to look like if I make it to 65, you know, which my sister did not. If I make it to 65, what does this look like? It doesn't look like this. It doesn't look like 2024, 2025 even. It ain't this.
How do I get from here to there? Do I do it?
So what does the path look like from here to there? I'm doing a lot of thinking about that. Yeah. And so, I haven't got it figured out, but I do think that I taking the foot off the gas on marketing was step one. That freed up a lot of time and it had zero impact on the business. And I was like, okay, that's a neat trick.
There it is. April Dunford marketing strategy. Don't market.
Don't do anything.
Build it, man.
I don't know. Like, I think what there is you build a certain amount of momentum and then depending on what your goals were, right? Like, it'd be different if I had some big agency, you know, and I was trying to just grow and I had 100 mouths to feed, you know, that'd be different. And it'd be different if I wasn't 58, you know, and kind of looking at, hey, this thing has only got to work for a few more years. Like, you know, it'd be different again if I was in my 30s and I'd be worried about, well, what's the pipeline look 3 years from now? Maybe it's not going to look so good if you just stop marketing. But at this point, I'm a bit like, maybe I could just stop all that stuff or pop up once in a while, you know, do some MVP of a marketing plan.
That's amazing. There you have
it. We're really grateful that you didn't stop showing up on podcasts. That would have been a big loss.
Yeah, well, for a while, I was doing a lot. Like, I mean, in 2024, I did 3 podcasts a week as a guest. Every week. Every week I was in the office. Like, if I was out with a client, I wouldn't do any. But if I was in the office, on average, I had 3 a week. And then this year, I backed way off on it. So I'm still doing them, but it's mainly like I know somebody or they're nice or whatever. Like, I know you guys. So I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll do your podcast. But just random people call me up and podcast. I'm a little bit like, maybe not. You know, sometimes I say yes, but a lot of the times I say no. So I'm trying to just be less strivey about the whole thing. Like, you know, at the beginning of the business where you're just like, oh my God, every opportunity, I got to take it, got to take it, got to, got to, got to. And now I'm a bit like, eh. Don't have to.
Well, you've earned it. That's
it's
the result of hard work, right?
We all hope we get to this point, right?
That's right.
But part of it is realizing that you're there.
Yes. Right?
Wise words.
Those are wise words. All righty. April, thank you.
Thank you, April.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
This was great.